Hi, this is Michael Steed. In this podcast, I'd like to have a look at trusts and the way that they operate for tax. So in other words, are there any tax planning opportunities in respect of trusts? Well, we need to ask some basic questions like, you know, what is a trust? What does it do? Why have them? Is it just tax? And what sort of trusts are there? And, you know, where have the changes been? And what's so important about March 2006 and all that kind of stuff? So let's have a look right at the beginning at the question, what is a trust? Well, they've been around for an awful long time, right back to sort of Norman times. And it was to protect families, miners, particularly when Dad went off to war and didn't come back. And he would often entrust his best friend by saying, why don't you look after this for the benefit of my son, who is in his minority, and you just sort of hold it on trust for him. So rights of the son grew up out of that. And of course, we know and love that whole business now as trust law. And there are the tax angles that we're going to be looking at. So what's a trust? It's where you have a separation of ownership. The person who puts the stuff into the trust is known as the settlor. And he puts it into a trust, or they use the old word, the word settlement. And the people who look after the trust, this cardboard box full of all these assets, are known as the trustees. And the key point is that the trustees have the legal ownership, if you like, their names on the title of the share certificates or the property, whatever it is. But they only hold the legal ownership. They hold the beneficial ownership, as it were, on trust for the beneficiaries. So the beneficiaries have the beneficial ownership or equitable ownership, and the trustees have just the legal ownership. Traditionally, governments have always taken the view that it's the wicked old tax planners who recommend trusts, and it's a good way of avoiding tax, and therefore we, the government, need to sort of lean on them and leap on them and all the usual malarkey in there. But to my eye, there's a much more important reason for having a trust, and that is the protection of property. And the classic example there would be somebody who wanted to leave some money for his children. Maybe he won it on the lottery, but he was a bit leery about giving direct gifts in some cases because he was worried that the money would be squandered or the particular child was married badly or whatever the reason is. So sometimes putting the assets, the money, the cash, the property into trust can be very important from a protection point of view. And so I look at it from two angles. It's not only the tax, it's also the protection of property. And yes, there are tax planning things that you can do, but there's another way of looking at that, that actually you have to consider the tax burden on trusts. And certainly when we look at what are called discretionary trusts in just a second, then we'll see that there are regular tax charges attached to those discretionary trusts. Now, what sort of trusts are there? Well, there's a whole list of them. You know, we could go on for quite a while here. There are bare trusts. There are accumulation and maintenance trusts, discretionary trusts, interest in possessions, trust with an immediate post-death interest, protected trust, trust for bereaved minors. The list goes on. And there are still a few more that I haven't mentioned. But we'll pick up on the main ones in just a wee while. But for IHT purposes, by which I mean not for CGT or for IT, it was all change on the 22nd of March 2006. And a lot of the old trusts, for example, the accumulation and maintenance trust, by which typically grandpa or grandma will put some money into a trust for the benefit of their grandchildren's education. Good news for grandma and granddad, because the pot grew out of their estate. Good news for the children, because they were going to have their school fees paid. But the point about those sorts of trusts is that the tax treatment became much less benign in March 2006. And that's the bit we need to keep our eye on, because a lot of those lost their sort of better tax treatment, if you like, and are now aligned into a group known as relevant property trusts. not a very happy phrase, not a very useful phrase, but it just means trusts, and here it goes, that have regular tax charges on them. It's possible to have tax charges on the way in, depending upon the size of the gift, regular 10-year tax charges, and then tax charges when property leaves the trust and goes to beneficiaries. So all up then, the magic stick in the sand on the 22nd of March 2006 meant that the more benign old world was going to be replaced by a slightly more tax-savage modern world. And that's the one that we're in at the moment. And if you want sort of hole-in-one on that, then all discretionary trusts, and they're very useful in practice because trustees have absolute discretion on where it goes, so you can't have the waster member of the family taking money that the trustees don't want him to have. Then in those circumstances, all of those in this modern world, discretionary trusts, are going to have this regular tax treatment. But there are some that have a slightly more benign tax treatment. An example of that would be a trust with an immediate post-death interest. And I'll deal with those in just a second. So far, we've listed the sorts of trusts. We've said that the most important trusts in lifetime are the discretionary trusts, and the most important trusts set up on death are, rather an unhelpful phrase, isn't it, but an immediate post-death interest trust, an IPD. And we've also logged the 22nd of March 2006, a lot of trusts migrated, or they're given a couple of years to migrate, and by 2008 at the latest, they're all treated under this big family of trusts for IHT purposes. They are the relevant property trusts, and they have regular tax charges. That's the key thing. So, just to rehearse it, the most important trusts are probably discretionary trusts, and they're classically set up in lifetime. And there are trusts set up on death. And the three that I'd like to focus on are trusts with an immediate post-death interest. I'll explain the meaning of that in just a second. Trusts for bereaved minors. That's where dad or mum pops off early. And we can put some stuff into a trust for their children who have not yet reached the age of 18. And then there's a modified version of that particular trust for a bereaved minor, called the 18 to 25 trust. Right, well, let's go back then and have a look at some of these lifetime trusts. I suppose one of the most important ones here, the discretionary trust by probably quite a wide margin. But there are also bare trusts and trusts for the disabled. Now, what's a bare trust? Sometimes these are called simple trusts, where the trustee holds the legal ownership on behalf of the beneficiary, and the beneficiary is absolutely entitled to the trust property and any income that arises from it. There's no interest in possession. There's no discretionary right. It's very, very simple. And these trusts are transparent for tax purposes. In other words, as the beneficiary is absolutely entitled to the trust property, that property is going to be included in the value of the beneficiary's estate on death, and he will simply be entitled to the income. So you don't have to put in trust tax returns. The money from the trust, if there's any arising, the income simply is put into the beneficiary's tax return. They're not that common, really, bare trusts. You do sometimes see them. You occasionally see a solicitor who says, oh, yes, I think this should be set up under a bare trust, but they're dead simple. Another way that bare trusts are used is where if you're making a raid on a company and you want to buy some shares, but you don't want them to know it's you that's buying them, you can get one of your friends to buy it and they will put it in their name, but they're simply holding those shares on bare trust for you. But the key thing is that if any money, income, dividends arises from those shares, it's not the trustees, there's no tax return. It's simply logged in the beneficiary's, that is, tax return. A trust for the disabled. If property is held on trust for a disabled person, then that person is treated as if they had what's called a qualifying interest in possession in that property, which gives them the unalienable right to have it, whether it's the use of a house or whether it's income maybe dividends from shares. And that means that it's treated as part of his estate. So it's charged to IHT on that disabled person's death. Okay, so that's bare trusts, quick word on trusts for the disabled, but let's have a slightly deeper look at discretionary trusts. Now, if we were to just stand back and ask about tax treatment of trusts and the way that we can use them perhaps to advantage, I think here we just need to recognise that we need to think about IHT, then income tax, then CGT. And I think it's just worth reminding yourself that the rule changes in 2006, which made a lot of these trusts now look and feel like discretionary trusts, that is that they are relevant property trusts. These rule changes are only for IHT. It doesn't change the landscape as far as income tax or capital gains tax is concerned. Okay, so that's sort of a big picture bit there. But let's have a look at discretionary trust. Remember, here the trustees have absolute discretion. Now, what are the tax treatment of a discretionary trust, generically now called relevant property trusts? Well, you will get a potential charge to IHT in three ways, at three different points. First, when the trust is set up, because the transfers of property in are called, and here another family generic title, they are called chargeable lifetime transfers. In other words, they are potentially subject to IHT at the lifetime rates, which you will recall are 20%. That is exactly one half of the death rates. So when we set the trust up and we put property in, those are going to be chargeable to tax to IHT. There's a second point at which tax is charged, and that is when the property leaves the trust, and therefore it's no longer trust property, and there will be what is known in the speak as an exit charge. And the third occasion of a tax charge is on the 10th and successive 10th anniversaries of the creation of the trust, and that's known as the principal charge, or most people colloquially refer it to as the 10-year charge. So let's think about going in. If I put just a modest amount of money in, it's different. And this is the key point to get in your heads. Putting money into a trust is fundamentally different to giving money to somebody else, at least from an IHT point of view. Because you'll take the point that if I give money to somebody else, this could be, you know, grandma leaving money to or giving money in life to her grandchildren, then those gifts are potentially exempt transfers. That is, they are pets. And the characteristic of a pet is that there is no tax charged in lifetime. And indeed, there will continue to be no tax charged, provided the donor, in my example, grandma, actually survives 7 years. You'll also hopefully recall that if grandma doesn't survive 7 years, then there will be a tax charge, and it's always on the donee of the gift, the person who receives the gift, which is often quite unwelcome news, although you can do certain things about that, like insure against it, and in any event, the closer they get to the 7 years survival, the taper relief kicks in to lower the tax charge. So that's not too bad, so a little bit of good news in there. So when I put my money into the discretionary trust, by way of contrast, this time, instead of it being a pet, it's going to be chargeable now. It is a chargeable lifetime transfer. Now, remember, at the point that I put my money into the discretionary trust, I may not have a tax charge if I've still got some nil rate band, £325,000, to play with. So if I hadn't made any gifts to discretionary trusts in the last 7 years, then I start out at nil, and I can fund the trust up to £325,000. Oh, incidentally, plus my £3,000 annual exemption. But let's call it 325 for round numbers. 325K, I can pop that into the trust. And because the gift is soaked up by the nil rate band, there's nothing to pay. But if I then make another gift within a year or two into the trust, I'm still within the 7-year accumulator, and therefore my second and subsequent gifts are likely to be hit tax to the extent that they're over the nil rate band, and therefore I will pay tax on that excess at 20%. So that's the key thing. When I'm putting money into the trust, I've got to think about the potential tax hit. Now, the tax charged at 20% will be, in one example, one possibility, will be borne by the trustees. But if the donor, the person who made the gift to the settlement, when that person also, and here very generously, agrees to pay the tax, then the tax rate rises. And it's not 20%, it's 25%. So it makes sense, in a way, for the trustees to pay the tax, because the tax rate, where it's due, that is to the extent that it's above the 325, that is going to be at 20%. But if the donor, also who's given the gift, pays the tax, then the tax rate sadly rises by 5%. Okay, those are the sort of the classic entry charges. Every 10 years, that trust will be subject to a 10-year charge, known as the principal charge. And very crudely, it is 6% of the current value of the fund. So you have to factor in, for the price of having discretion and therefore protection of property, that every 10 years, 6% of the current value is going to be soaked up in this principal charge. And there's also going to be other charges on exit. And there are set rules which I think are sort of a bit beyond what I'm trying to do here in this podcast. If you have an exit before the principal charge, you calculate it in a certain way. And if you have an exit, that is a gift to a beneficiary, after a principal charge, then that's going to be taxed in a slightly different way. But that's not what I'm trying to do in this podcast. What I'm trying to do here is to sort of get an overview, get a feel for what happens to the taxation of trusts. Okay, just to pull that lot together then. Gifts into discretionary trusts, and people will still refer to them as discretionary trusts, for IHT purposes, they are now known by their modern term of RPTs. That's the relevant property trusts. There'll be discretionary trusts proper, plus, of course, the old accumulation and maintenance trusts, which have migrated to being relevant property trusts as well. So the classic scenario in which granddad and grandma want to pop some money into a trust for the beneficiaries being their grandchildren, then we're talking, for IHT purposes, about relevant property trusts. Sorry, the titles aren't great here, are they? But there you go. Can't really help that one. Okay, that's the discretionary trust, which is the classic example of an RPT and the classic example of a lifetime trust. But what I want to do now is to have a look at trusts that are set up on death. Now, just to recall, there are three types. There are trusts with an immediate post-death interest, that's the IPDI. There are trusts for bereaved minors, and then there are an extension of that trust for bereaved minors, known as the 18 to 25 trust. Now, what is an immediate post-death interest trust? Well, the classic example, and these used to be called interest in possession trusts, are where husband and wife divorce, and they have children, and then husband, say, remarries, and his wife is, just for the purposes of my example here, quite a bit younger than him, because I want him to die first, you see. And the provisions of his will are that on his death, his second wife, because clearly he's not at all bothered by what happens to his first wife, he leaves the house to. And what I mean by that is that he doesn't leave the capital of the house. He leaves the right to live in it to his second wife. Because what he wants to do is to protect the property itself, and hence my point about protection being important, for his children from his first marriage. Let's just assume again, for very simple purposes, that there are no children of the second marriage. So he wants them to benefit, but he doesn't want his wife, his second wife, to be thrown out on the streets in her lifetime. So the classic way of dealing with that, and again, I stress it's more about protection of property, she is allowed to live in the house. She is referred to, therefore, as the life tenant. And the children, in due course when she dies, are referred to as the remainder men. And gosh, that's quite an old-fashioned sounding title, isn't it? So in this immediate post-death interest trust, remember these have been around since 2006, then wife number two is protected in the sense that she has a roof over her head for the rest of her life, but she can't do anything with the house because she doesn't own the capital. She only has the utility, the right, the income, if you like, that flows from that house. And here, that utility is the right to live there. So in other words, a roof over her head. Before 2006, you could set these trusts up both in life and in death. And they're known generically as interest in possession trusts. And some of these older pre-2006 IIPs, interest in possession, are actually still around. But the key point is that now you can't create any more of those, and the only way that you can give somebody like a second wife an interest in possession is on the death. You can't set these up in life, on the death of, and again in my example, the husband. So there's the IPTI, the trust with an immediate post-death interest. You may recall the sting in the tail here, and that is that when wife number two dies, even though she doesn't own the property, it's included in her death estate. And it's known as settled property. And it's added into the pot. So her estate is swelled by the value of this house that ironically she doesn't own. Now, there will be tax to pay, and it is calculated along with the rest of her estate. But here's one crumb of comfort. The tax is not actually borne by her, or to be more accurate, the benefit of the people who look after her will, the personal representatives, but it is borne by the trustees of that trust. And then, of course, on her death, the property passes to the children, and then that's hopefully the end of our story. Okay, so that's the IPTI that ends on the death of the second wife there. But I just want to quickly talk, as we sort of begin to wind this up, about trusts for children. Now, before 2006, there was a sort of a general view that children, minor children, and indeed 18, was basically far too young to be left trust property, especially when the values were quite significant. And therefore, people had these accumulation and maintenance trusts, which allowed the trustees to hold on to the capital until the beneficiaries were 25. But in 2006, the then government, changed all that, which still strikes a lot of people, me included, as being fairly astonishing, because not a lot of 18-year-olds will have the maturity to deal with trust property, especially when you've got fairly considerable sums. So, to recap then, as far as trusts for children are concerned in this modern age, we've got two of them. The first of these are the so-called trusts for bereaved minors, and that comes straight out of the Inheritance Tax Act, Section 71A, if you're interested. And basically, it's set up on death because it's part of this group of trusts that can only be set up on death. And it's created either through the will of the beneficiary's parent or by the rules of intestacy. Remember, that means that where the parent dies without making a will. And the point is that the beneficiary becomes, that's the child, becomes absolutely entitled to the trust income and the trust capital by the age of 18. So that's the bit that makes an awful lot of people, me included, very uncomfortable. And I don't see why the rules were changed, except it was just a way of bashing people who take out trusts. Now, if you decided that 18 was simply far too early, then you can go for a modified form of trust for a bereaved minor. I would think of this as the extension trust, if you like, and they're called 18 to 25 trusts. And it's pretty much the same as a trust for a bereaved minor. That is, it comes out of the will. But the entitlement to capital is deferred until the age of 25. You can have it out before, but 25 is the latest that you can hold on to it. So when the trust is set up, and because that's got to be on death, the assets entering the trust will have already been subject to IHT on the settlor's death, because that's part of their death estate, that's part of normal IHT calculation. But here's the point. There's no inheritance tax to pay. If the capital is paid to or applied for the beneficiary while they're under the age of 18. But when you pass the age of 18 on your way down to 25, then IHT payments are due if the payments are made. In other words, you get an exit charge, which I referred to when I was talking about discretionary trusts. Okay, now, as we head on down towards the end of this podcast, let me just think for a little bit about the income tax treatment of trusts. Because do you take the point that if you've got income arising out of a trust, say a classic discretionary trust, and you then want to hand it to your beneficiaries, or you've got an interest in possession, or in modern parlance, an IPD trust, and you've got, instead of it being the house, you've got some income arising, then we need to just ask the question, well, what's that for tax? One, from the point of view of the trust itself, in other words, the trustee's tax position, and then, because they tend to be handing out money where it's not a house, say, where it's income, it's dividends, on the beneficiaries, and therefore, the second part of this, we need to consider the beneficiary's tax position. Okay, so let's start off then with the interest in possession trust. This is where maybe we've got a pre-2006 trust. We set up a pot for somebody, the life tenant. Remember, they've got the absolute right to have that trust, to have that trust money. Another circumstance in which this can be set up would be perhaps in a more modern scenario where we have the immediate post-death interest where dad, instead of leaving a house to his second wife, supposing he left a lump of money or some Barclays shares or some such, and she could have the income arising out of the lump of cash or the dividends arising out of the shares. So what I want to do first is to have a look at the interest in possession, or in the more modern parlance, the IPDIS. Right, let's start with the trustees then. So they've got income coming in. Let's say we've got some dividends and we've got some cash on deposit, which has given us some sort of savings income there. It could even be we've got some property that's been let. So we've got some property income as well. Right, as far as the trustees are concerned, in calculating the tax liability, we don't actually take any deduction for the trust management expenses. In other words, if the trustees have to retain you to do the trust accounts, which are, you know, moderately straightforward, and the tax comp, which are moderately straightforward too in most cases, and you send in your bill, say for 300 plus VAT or 300 if you're not that registered, they can't take that off in determining the tax liability. Where that comes into effect is when they've worked out the tax and then they've got their income less the tax liability, and then they're looking at the amount that's available for distribution. That is when the management expenses come off. So the hit, if you like, is on the beneficiary. So no deduction for trust management expenses. And very interestingly, as far as the trustees are concerned, all of the income is taxed at the basic rate. So we don't get any trust rates, any higher rates like sort of 50% or 42.5%. Those come in on discretionary trusts. So the rates of tax are 20% for non-savings income, such as property income, and then 20% for savings income, such as interest, and then dividends are taxed at 10%. And then the beneficiary's tax position is that the person who's the beneficiary in the interest in possession trust, or the IPD as it's more modernly called, they're entitled to receive the trust income once the tax has been paid and the expenses are settled out of the net income. and they will then be given the R185 with, you know, with the sums on it, with all the tax credits and so on and so forth. Now, I don't propose to go into the detail of that because this is a high-level look at the tax on trusts. So that's the first thing. That's how we actually deal with the tax on interest in possession trust, now in the modern parlance, arising in death only, known as the IPDIS. As far as a discretionary trust is concerned, the trustee's expenses are a bit different because the trustees can deduct the expenses in their income tax computation. But then you have to do in the tax computation a little adding back of tax in order to cover the fact that you've paid out expenses and thus reduce your tax liability. And again, those fine mechanical details are beyond what I'm trying to do in this podcast, but I just want to make that point that the tax position is slightly different. And once the expenses have been deducted, discretionary trusts then have a basic rate or a standard rate on the first £1,000 of income only. So that'll be at either 10 or 20. And then anything over that is taxed at one of two special trust tax rates. And those are the equivalent to the tax, the rates that the additional rate taxpayers pay currently, and therefore they're 50%, unless it's dividend income, of course, when that's 42.5%. So all up then, sort of drawing the strings together as we head on down towards the finish of this podcast, I just want to make the point and underscore it that it's almost like you want to protect property and therefore you're putting stuff into trust and you're putting up with the tax hit. And yes, there's slightly different tax treatments here. And yes, there are some more sophisticated bits of tax planning, which again are beyond what I'm trying to do here today, because this is just to sort of paint up the principles so that when we have those conversations with clients, we at least know the difference between a bare trust and a discretionary trust and an interest in possession stroke IPD trust. So there is my review, my high-level review of trusts and the tax treatment of those. So hopefully that's been of some use. I look forward to seeing you all as soon as possible on some of the events we've got planned for the autumn and the spring. And I look forward to that. Cheerio.